is Casey Must. I'm the owner and founder of Citizen Yoga, and you are listening to After Class. After Class is our podcast where we get to interview community members, students, our teachers, to really bring forward our true mission, which is suicide prevention through community building, education, yoga, of course, and many other traditions. This series of our podcast is called Heart of the Room, where we have the honor of interviewing some of our incredible teachers. And so today I have Rachel Cimentelli here with me, and I'm so excited to start our conversation about so many incredible topics.
Thank you, Casey. Thank you so much for the opportunity, and I'm really excited to get into it with you.
We've done so many calls about what we wanted to talk about, because I think we want to talk about everything.
There's never enough time. I know.
That's so true. Well, Rach, I always, I won't say always, I haven't as much this season, but I like to, when I remember, to start particularly with our teachers, with a question about your personal mission and really defining for the people listening what that is for you, because I know that that goes way beyond asana.
Yeah, thank you for that question. And every time I listen to the podcast, I always love hearing everyone's answers. And for me, I'm going to keep it a little more broad because obviously I do more than just teaching yoga. And, you know, I did a lot of brainstorming and sort of journaling around this, mainly because you're one of my mentors and you kind of always are encouraging people to be like, what's your mission statement?
Drive it in your brain.
So, thank you. But yeah, you know, for me, the collection of offerings that I have through my personal business and through teaching yoga, to me, I seek to build relationships with people, with students or with clients, where I'm offering a space to remind people through patience, guidance, bearing witness, to return to being empowered by and finding sovereignty in your body, and to sort of heal and teach ways to come back to that whole embodied, confident, trusting version of yourself. And to me, it's about this sort of idea that there are so many circumstances and challenges in our lives that kind of pull us away from that. And something that I talk about a lot when people are asking me about this mission statement is like the idea of a baby, the way they look when they sleep and how they breathe. And we talk about breathing so much in yoga and how like the diaphragm is connected to the nervous system and how, you know, when you have too much tension there, it stimulates a stress response. But little babies, their bellies are round and they breathe with a full belly. And it's sort of, to me, that's like the image that this mission state evokes, is like a return to that embodied experience of feeling healed, you know, a time before maybe all those stresses or challenges created constriction in the body, tension, you know, trauma. And I like to envision that little sleeping baby with a round free breath.
That's awesome. And, you know, I was thinking while you were speaking about sort of this idea of self-sovereignty and really becoming the center of your own circumstances and how we do that through asana and philosophy. And I think that what you do in your other sort of section of your life is really the reminder that we get to choose how we experience something versus the experience choosing it for us. I think that's part of being a human being, but it's also the power that we lose when we collect all of this tension throughout our lives. And so I think that that was something that really stood out to me was, oh, like I need to, you help people, even when you said it, like the patience, the bearing witness, it even reminded me as you said it, like, oh, Casey, go, go right to the center of your circumstances, go right to that center of your circumference, and remember that you have an ability to release tension in your body through so many tools, which I think is part of what you offer.
Mm-hmm. I love that word, unwinding. And something that I also love to talk about with people is, like, you know, we've all heard this sort of, it's almost cliche now, but like, healing isn't linear, right? So what is it? It's a spiral. And that, to me, like, again, the word unwinding, it sort of evokes this image of a spiral of, like, you know, you might visit something in your asana or in your meditation or in your therapy, whatever modality you're working with, you know, you might see something and think it's resolved, and then you circle back around and it might look the same, and you might think to yourself, I thought I'd been through this, but you're just a layer lower, you're a layer deeper. You've gone around in a circle and you've come back with a different perspective, hopefully a deeper one. And I really like to sort of think about my own healing process, and also, you know, when I'm in relationship with clients or with friends, to just remind people that, like, that's not a failure. That doesn't mean that you haven't done the work. It's just that that's the nature of healing.
I sometimes feel, and we'll talk about what you do outside of yoga, because I feel like we're leaving that as a secret to the listeners. Not intentionally. We're just speaking because we're so familiar with each other. But this idea of sort of same lesson with a different lens, I think we, like, have, I know for myself, but I think a lot of us feel exactly what you're saying, like, oh, again, I have to see this again. I have to see this again. But you're always a different person with a different lens, hopefully deeper in the center, so you can handle the spiral. Because I don't really think of it as, like, undoing the spiral. It's like tuning into the spiral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're just traveling.
Yeah. So
deep, you know, deeper into yourself.
Sorry. Yeah. That's exactly. So can you just talk to us about, besides our prenatal, besides teaching asana with us and meditation, what are you doing outside of this space that sort of felt like your big calling?
Yeah. So, you know, the other side of my business is being a doula. I work as a birth and postpartum and holistic fertility doula. Mm-hmm. And I also offer Reiki.
Mm.
So there's those sort of two sides of it. Another thing that I've been working on in my personal business that I sort of consider being part of my holistic fertility doula offerings is some learning modules. And we've sort of been dipping into that in my offerings with Citizen through, you know, doing the Citizen X groups, small groups on Zoom, and talking about how we can use, you know, the different limbs of yoga to support our hormone cycles and support the menstrual cycle. So you've kind of, you know, people who might have been seeing that offering, seeing my name pop up, and that's in that way is sort of part of my holistic fertility training. And that is, you know, not just for people trying to get pregnant. I've worked with a lot of people who just have issues with their cycle, who have really common but not normal, you know, problems.
Rach, will you repeat that? I just want to acknowledge for the people at home who are listening that we are in the middle of COVID, so we are not together next to our microphone, which is usually how I interact with people. So there was, like, a little cutout there.
Yeah.
You said you work with people with their cycle.
So the part about the holistic fertility doula is just that, you know, you've been perhaps seeing my name pop up in the Citizen X offerings with ways to use yoga, different limbs of yoga and other self-care practices to support the hormone cycle and to support the menstrual cycle. So my holistic fertility doula offerings are really, you know, I use that term, but it's a very broad umbrella that includes helping people just with their, you know, supporting any issues that they're having around their cycle, far and wide. So not just people trying to get pregnant.
So what is a doula? Let's start there, because I think it's really confusing to know why you would hire a doula. I know that it's not confusing if you Google it, but if you're not in that realm of sort of alternative birthing or haven't been through it, or maybe you have been through it, but you're not sure whether or not a doula is right for you. What is a doula's role?
Well, I'll just start out with a really broad definition, because a doula is not just about birth. A doula, really, at its most broad definition, is someone who's a guide, a guardian, an advocate for any major transformational moment in a human being's life. And what doulas do is sort of honor and hold space around the moments that are rites of passage for human beings, and that our culture in its current state has really failed to honor for us. So, you know, a doula is somebody who supports transitional times. You can be a, you know, someone who is a birth doula, postpartum doula. We have death doulas. And so that's sort of, I like to provide that broad explanation, because we are seeing more and more services out there around people, you know, informational, educational, emotional support around all of these moments of rites of passage for human beings. I personally, obviously, as we just talked about, am a birth and postpartum doula, but I consider myself a full spectrum doula. And that just really means that, you know, I'm supporting all reproductive outcomes for people who can get pregnant. So that means I support people who are, you know, maybe exploring all of the pregnancy choices. You know, my work is inclusive of all outcomes and identities of those possibilities. So, you know, in a lot of ways it is political, and we can get into that more later. But as a full spectrum doula, I offer support for people, including miscarriage, abortion, birth, and postpartum.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things that you had talked to me about, I didn't realize that doulas were used for all transitions. And I think that that's what is so difficult throughout our life, is that we're so unprepared for all transitions. Even though we know that transitions, they're happening every single day, they're happening in more of a microcosm sort of way, but those big transitions that you know are inevitable, you know, birth, loss of parents, loss of significant other, all of those things, we don't, you're right, in the way that you said, sort of a guardian. I like that phrase. We don't really have a guardian or a go-to to really help facilitate our transitioning through that, which is really interesting. And that's maybe why people lived more in communities, in bigger communities, exactly, than how we live right now, which is, you know, you're always nervous to call your friend to tell them that you're struggling or you're suffering and you're not quite sure who to turn to. So everybody, and not in a bad way, people have therapists. But I think that there's sort of this in-between role. Eric Hipple and I had mentioned it in our previous podcast, which is somebody to go to that isn't even a formal therapist when you're just having a hard time.
Yeah, I love that idea. And, you know, obviously I'm not a therapist, but I definitely have had a lot of experiences where I'm holding space for really, really big stuff, you know, and I'm not necessarily always giving advice, but just being present and bearing witness is really powerful. When you're in those moments of transition, having someone see you and validate you and say, like, I see what's happening here, is sometimes the difference between something being totally traumatizing and something being like just a challenge that you overcame.
So why you defined your part of your mission as helping people find patience. Patience with what? What are we most impatient about? And how do you create that bridge from being impatient to patient?
That's a great question. I think that it's twofold for me. I try to embody that quality when I'm dealing with my clients, but also, like you said, encouraging people to find that quality in themselves. And, you know, I think that human childbirth is really unique. It's not simply a physiological endeavor. right? Like the practices, the meanings, the social interactions that surround reproduction are just laden with cultural and political values. And they're also, you know, sort of steeped in this country anyways, in the medicalization, like it's been totally medicalized. And so you have a culture, a birth culture in this country where we're trying to exert predictability and control over a natural process that is in its very core unpredictable and uncontrollable. So
I think,
you know,
what you said is really important that you talked about, and I can see this in people. And of course, again, like everybody has different choices, and I have not, you know, been in that circumstance, but this idea of predictable control and convenience. I think that those are like, those are three American values that we have that can, are very counter to any kind of transition, actually.
Yeah,
because irrelevant
totally
of birth, it's predictable. How is it going to be? Control. When is it going to happen? You know, these are things that, inconvenience, of course, if it's inconvenient, people don't do it. So it's very counter.
It's, you know, when I talked about being, you know, a doula is someone who honors rites of passage. So, you know, a rite of passage is, you know, to get all nerdy on you, it's like a series of rituals that's designed to take, you know, your status as a person from one social status to another. And it transforms both your perception of yourself as an individual and your, and the society's perception of you as an individual. So, you know, when you have that such a significant transformation that's not being really honored, it creates in a lot of people a sort of schism or like crisis of identity.
Yeah.
Because no one is observing and validating the transformation. And in particular in the birth world, because of like I mentioned a moment ago about this medicalization of birth, that's a really new phenomenon. That's only like, you know, maybe 200 years out of human history that we've medicalized birth. And it's a really fascinating transformation. And obviously it's beyond the scope of this conversation, but to me as like an intersectional feminist nerd, I love learning about it.
Yep.
But suffice it to say that like the procedures in the obstetrical world and the birth world are a sort of way that we've coped with that schism. And they're in fact like a rational ritual response to the values that we have in American society, like you were just talking about, like this technocratic society, we have extreme fear of the natural processes. And and we have, you know, the doctors and patients who are performing and participating in this system, they believe that what they're doing is transforming that unpredictable, uncontrollable nature and turning it into this sort of technocratic phenomenon that we can just like go through and do the checklist. And it really does reflect some of the most fundamental beliefs in our society about the superiority of technology over nature. And I think that we see that everywhere in the health and self-care world. And this it also sort of eliminates this process of, not process, but it eliminates the need for us to be in a liminal space and to have that element of patience that you were just talking about,
right,
and the element of surrender, which is something that we do and practice all the time in yoga.
But do you think that you can have both, I guess, which I think in my world, I would want both. Do you think that they're so counter to each other, sort of like the medicalization of birth and then our nature of what happens? How do they coexist, or can, in your, this is of course your perspective, can they coexist?
I think that they are coexisting for a lot of people, and this is a highly subjective and very personal, you know, experience. And any person, any birthing person that you ask this question to, is going to have a different answer. My perspective, you know, as a doula is that right now they are coexisting. And my personal and political view is that I hope they don't have to in the future.
Mm-hmm. How is it political?
Well, I guess that's a complicated question. No, that's okay. Like, I'd love to go there, but, you know, it's political. It's okay.
You don't have to edit your thoughts. This is, people are listening. Don't edit your thoughts. This is you. And that's why people listen to podcasts too. I listened to a podcast about a guy that's a hunter. And I was like, I started the podcast, like, what an idiot. And I ended the podcast like, wow, I get it. So remember that people are listening, hopefully to encounter different opinions. And if you aren't listening for that, then you're just hanging out with people that agree with you, which isn't very helpful. So go for it. Just speak your truth.
So I'll just start with, a couple of things, that mainly that, like, when you look at the job of being a doula, like, being a doula is a result of a problem in the system that needed a solution. And because the system was unable to even recognize that there is a problem, there was sort of a grassroots uprising of people who decided to do something about this. And, we live in a society where power is concentrated in various institutions all over the place, right? This context, commercialized through technology, but always under the umbrella, our medical system especially, under the umbrella of capitalism and white supremacy and a ruling wealthy class where, our rites of passage, as I mentioned, have been ignored or rendered invisible or, I would say number one problem in a lot of situations is commodified in order to maintain the status quo of the society that we live in. I make the political choice to be radical, and I declare myself an advocate for my clients. And I say that, it's political because the only reason that my job exists is because the failure of the medical system to recognize, respect, honor our dignity and humanity and bodily autonomy through the process of medicalized birth. Like the rituals that exist around birth, around medicalized birth, hospital birth, are really, if you do the research, a lot of the time don't change or improve outcomes, but the ritualization of those processes are sort of, tying back to what I said about like our need to somehow shape the rite of passage to feel like we have control over something. And unfortunately, in the medical system, because the medical system operates under the umbrella of capitalism and patriarchy and white supremacy, it has created sometimes harmful and sometimes traumatizing experiences of birth. And doulas rose to fill the position of bringing humanity and dignity and respect and bodily autonomy back into that space because it was damaging. People were suffering and people still do. But I kind of consider my job as a doula hopefully will eventually not be needed anymore. Like, I work to put myself out of a job, in taking political action and having these kinds of conversations and in demanding that we not normalize these unnecessary and sometimes harmful sort of like cultural ideas around medical birth, that I work to change the culture and hopefully eventually so much so that my job is no longer necessary because people feel safe and empowered already. They don't need someone like me to be their advocate.
So I'm trying to link it all together. So you're saying, I do understand that. And again, I'm no expert, so please correct me as I sort of draw these connections and like rewire them as you feel necessary. This idea that we have tried to make the birthing process under a system that isn't really guided. I don't even have to use some of the words you use, but is not guided by ritual, is not guided by women, really, was not guided by women, particularly as it started, has forced certain aspects of medical care to become, we're forcing predictability, we're forcing control, we're forcing convenience onto something that really is more of a process, is it requires more patience, requires more autonomy on the individual's part, and that has been taken away. I don't think it's all bad intention. I think that it was taken away potentially for to help people, but I don't really know the statistics, which I think you do, on how well we're doing in, you know, infant mortality rates and how well we're doing there.
Yeah, I think, you know, I like the way you summarized that, and I think we're on the same page kind of around the sort of point that I'm trying to make. And I can tell you, like, I don't know the statistics off the top of my head, mm-hmm. but our infant and maternal mortality rates are abysmal for a developed
country,
first world country. We're doing terribly. The system does not work.
Yeah. So what is there a specific cause? And it especially
does not work for...
Like, are they, is there a correlation? Is there a specific cause to it? Or...
I think that it's a web of causes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We don't have to go deeper into
that. That would be a very big, you know, tangent or like arm to go down. But there are a lot of reasons, and, you know, some of them have to do with the way we are obsessed with that technology. And some of them have to do with, like I mentioned, the white supremacy that's deeply ingrained in our medical system. Mm-hmm. And some of them have with capitalism. There's a lot going on. I guess we don't that's have okay. to keep going down that route, but yeah, there's a lot of causes.
I want to like step, and I'm not sure if I want to step into this deep conversation of, I guess I have two questions to follow up, and then, mm-hmm. you know, we can, I'd love to ask you some more like practical questions as well, because I think that this information, though out there, there's a lot of misinformation out there. I was just explaining this to Larissa Flora, who's one of our beloved community members and teachers who now lives on the West Coast. And we were just sort of discussing how there is this huge wave of what I would call Tamasic intellect, Tamasic knowledge, which is to take a part of something and then categorize it as representing the whole, which I think is a huge problem in our country right now in terms of politics, medical information, particularly getting your news from social media, which is a horrible place to get your news from because it's preying on your mind, which your mind likes to take these little tidbits and draw conclusions without logic and reason. Mm-hmm. And I guess my question to you is, how do you navigate? How do I want to say this? How do you navigate finding correct information about this and being radical, but knowing that you being radical is also you being rational? But maybe that's a part of us like fighting against a system that always wants us to be perfect and rational. So like, you know what I mean? It's like this sort of like double question that I'm trying to like formulate for you, but that's where I feel there's a lot of confusion in the world right now of like verification of information and yet the denial of information, the misinformation, and all of this sort of tied into an uprising that needs to happen. And at the same way, sometimes I think people are very uneducated in how they make this uprising happen. Is that clear to you, Rach?
Yeah. Well, I'll start by just kind of talking about the basic idea of like, well, how do I know what the statistics are? How do I know what our actual results are, right? So that's a pretty simple answer. Like we know that because we have data coming out of the World Health Organization. We have data coming out. Every state does a thorough audit of infant and maternal mortality, and they categorize their data by race, by class. That, you know, we look at all of the causes of death for all of them, and how those categories correlate to that person's race, and we can get a lot of information by people who are analyzing statistical data that's coming out of hospitals on a yearly basis. Mm-hmm. So you get that information from your Department of Health, from, you know, the state works on that with a huge teams of people, and the United States does that as a whole for us, and then we have the World Health Organization who sort of looks at all of that in relationship to other countries. Mm-hmm. So that data is not really disputable. You can like read opinion articles about, you know, right, why you think that might be, but those, right, those are facts,
right,
that we, correct, can look at and confirm unequivocally.
Yeah, but I think that one of the things that I'm sort of mentioning to you, and I again, like, I wish I could go back to the beginning of my statement and like re-pull it around. But I think that, yeah, part of it is that people are reading opinions on the internet and thinking that they're truths, or they're thinking that they're facts. And I think that that's one of the scariest places that we're at right now. And just sort of to lay that down there, that I even taught my friend the other day the difference between a news article that literally says opinion piece and a news article that's actually a news article. Because, mm-hmm, just that kind of mental clarity and how you gain your information. I think that you've done a lot of research. I know you've done a lot of research. I know you've done a lot of research, and I want to honor that, because your conclusions are not based in your feelings, and your conclusions are not based in just your opinions. Your conclusions were based in knowledge, experience, and research. So I just, mm-hmm, want to like sort, yeah, of put that out there, that we're not just talking about your feelings right now.
Right, right. Yeah. And I'll say too that, you know, I mentioned this before, like, I'm a nerd about this stuff. I read the books. So, you know, if people are interested in sort of checking out, like, what are my like Bibles of like study for this year, I love sharing that with people. But
great,
there's a lot of research in anthropology and sociology in academia that are around this topic. And I pore over those texts, yeah, and that's really what feeds a lot of this. And there's also been a lot of books in the last 10 to 20 years that have come out around the history of the medical, of Western medicine, and particularly the history of the American medical, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, that culture and how that's arisen. And so there are really incredible historical books that are, you know, they're textbooks, really. They're not used, right, in high school, but they're textbooks, and they're based on primary sources. And I think, tying back to my statement about being a full spectrum doula, is sort of on the same theme as this, because when you're representing those people, you have to look at what voices have like sort of shaped, mm, our current culture, and what, mm, voices were left out. And for up until, mm, basically now, unless you're specifically studying Black history or Indigenous people's history, you don't hear those voices. And we're getting, you know, who writes the history book is huge. So,
yeah,
you know, that idea that, like, you know, the omission of voices and the omission of people's lived experience and the historical documentation of those lived experiences has shaped a culture that doesn't really reflect the whole story. And so what's, mm, happening right now in birth culture and in the medical world, you know, side of this uprising, is that now we get sources of the voices that didn't have an opportunity before this. The books are being written to represent those stories. And, you know,
I think that's a good way to talk about, like, having a radical point of view. Cause I would love to define what radical means. Because I think that radical right now has so many different meanings that maybe, I feel resistant to using the word radical anymore because I think there's a lot of like really, there are too many radical people. Like everybody's a free radical in the wrong direction potentially now. But I think that that's a really, I would love for you to define how we use the word radical, because even just this thought of using radical as a way of including voices that were never heard, you know, like radically opening your mind, radically looking at something, like what is this definition of this word and how are we using it?
Well, I can tell you my definition, and I don't know that other people would agree, but I use that word because my beliefs and my work revolve around upending the status quo. And to me, that's what radical means. It means that I'm defining my role as a doula, whether it's for birth or postpartum or to help people with their cycles. I am undoing the work that the systems that exist now have created. I'm like trying to help people recover from the damage that the existing systems have caused. And, you know, you can be a doula and decide that you're not political and that you just like helping people give birth. And there are tons of doulas out there who view their role that way. And so when I say I'm making the choice to declare myself radical, I'm saying that I see that there are power dynamics at play in the world that my clients are walking through. And I work to advocate to like help them navigate that, to upend those power dynamics because they're harmful. And so to me, that's what radical means in my work. I'm making a concentrated effort and doing actionable things, I hope anyway, to try and subvert the status quo.
I mean, I think that's a really good way to sort of like, not, I don't mean end this chapter of our conversation, but like, that's a really beautiful transition to say, to define what radical means to you. Cause I think that that's a very thoughtful definition of radical. And just looking at the definition of it, it says relating to or affecting the fundamental nature of something, which is really interesting, like an overhaul of the existing framework. Mm-hmm. Which is so beautiful in thinking about the sort of the context, the framework that you're talking about, which the framework was built by a certain perspective. I think that's a nice way to put it. It was built by a nice being like gentle. that's what I meant by nice, a gentle way of putting it. It was built by a certain framework. And I love this idea that you can hire somebody to be a voice that you don't even know is missing in your, in your transition. Mm-hmm. I feel like that about philosophy, that philosophy for me was the voice that I needed to hear that was left out of traditional education that told me, hey, life, you don't have to just be a victim to all the ups and downs of your life. And to me, like, that's what philosophy is it's like, it's my own doula. My teacher was more like a transitional helper to like sort of weather the storm of undescribed, not talked about difficulties in your life that are just what high school class did you go through that somebody said like, yeah, you might have a tough time in college. You might be depressed. Alcohol is not that great. You know, like you, not that, I mean, they don't really say that. It's like, there's a social norm of like, it is okay. And you know, that's what you look forward to is like drinking at a football game. Not that that's wrong. I'm not saying it's wrong, but not one person sort of mentioned the difficulty of potentially what's to come or what was happening in high school or in middle school or on and on and on and on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I also want to kind of honor and identify something that you're touching on and that I know you believe in, but you haven't quite explicitly named, is the fact that spirituality has been eradicated from those processes as well. And so there's a constant searching by so many people to somehow find a sense of spiritual connection in these moments of transition. And part of why I find it is so utterly important to highlight the part of bearing witness is because it's so validating when you're going through a spiritual journey or growth process, when you have someone who saw you in the beginning, who watched mm-hmm. you go through it without judgment, you know, maybe even without guidance. They just observed, they just bore mm-hmm. witness. And then at the end to mm-hmm. say, I see what you did.
Mm-hmm.
How incredibly transformative mm-hmm. just that can be for someone to say, mm-hmm. you know, if someone who knew me at the beginning of college and then who knew me now, or even just in the last 5 years, like yeah. my best friend in the whole wide world, we talk about that all the time of like, thank you for bearing witness to me, because it's so mm-hmm. validating to know that someone has seen me do mm-hmm. this, has seen me grow. And that's an incredibly spiritual act. And kind of going back to the role of doula, that's what's also missing in a human mm-hmm. childbirth, the way we know it in the United States, is that this is a deeply spiritual process. You are facing mm-hmm. the portal of life and death, not only facing it, but you become it. Your mm-hmm. body as a gestational parent, birthing person, becomes the portal between what's here and what's not here, between life and mm-hmm. death itself. And if you can't acknowledge that as spiritual, you will never fully be able to embody that, you know, transformation of identity. And so that's what I try to help people do too. And I just wanted to like try and grab onto that before we turn to the corner to a new topic, is just bring it back to that this is spiritual. And that's a huge part of what's missing in the current culture.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know that I agree deeply with that. I think you do that very well. I mean, I'll just tell the listeners, you know, Rachel called me this summer and I shared this with our whole team because we do appreciation circles in our staff meeting. And I really think Rach back to that phone call. Rachel called me. I was just driving up north and there was so much going on with COVID. And I can't remember, Rach, when it was, but like the actual time, I think it was maybe in July.
Yeah.
And she just, you acknowledged my own changing and how much I've changed from the time you met me, or how much I'm holding, or how, you know, how I'm really trying to help and hold people. And what I'm suggesting is not what Rachel said. It wasn't our conversation, is between us, but the power of doing that for a person is that was very significant to me personally. It was like, oh my God, thank you for seeing me. Like, I'm just like working so hard, and thank you. I didn't know I needed that, but I needed somebody to just witness it and acknowledge it. And I think that for the people who are listening, maybe that's part of this. One of the takeaways from this is like, think about somebody who you're watching go through a great transformation and not even like qualify it, just acknowledge it, not say it was good, it was bad, you know, like, oh, good job. Just acknowledge the transformation is occurring. And maybe that's why, just to speak to the medical industry, I remember when, you know, my sister was having her first baby and you're only allowed one person, or it was two people, but, in the room with you. And I understand why. There's no, in a hospital setting, I get it, but there was so much like, oh my God, but I should be there to help you through this experience and be there with you and, you know, and witness your own transformation. And I think that was probably, my first experience of being like, well, what has happened here? And why aren't we, and not to say that everybody wants that, not everybody wants that closeness. And I acknowledge that, but I definitely would want that. And the thought of just being able to pick one person or two people, it's like, wait, where are the people? This is going to be intense, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. That's like what I think of.
Yeah, there's something about us as human beings that we have this craving, many people do, for this to be like a community acknowledged event. And our, mm-hmm. you know, it's really hard to find that in the current system. And I think, you know, mm-hmm. I thank you for sort of, you know, highlighting that, and also, you know, thank you for your kind words. And I think that it just speaks to this idea that you strive so much and so often so hard in this community of citizen to highlight of like how meaningful it is to feel seen, And it's a, it's just a universal human need, no matter what the context. Mm. And it can change, it can completely transform an experience from, you know, like I said in the beginning, from being something that's like, you just are overcoming a challenge that you look back on with mm-hmm. pride of an accomplishment versus like it being traumatizing. Sometimes all that's mm-hmm. necessary to change that is for someone to have truly seen you.
Mm.
That's my personal
or transformative. Opinion. Yeah. You know, or transformative. Mm-hmm. I think that that's, you know, that to me is like one of the biggest things is, I mean, I admittedly am so, if you know me, anybody who's listening, if you know me and you know how afraid I am of physical pain, I'm like the worst patient ever. And we always joke that like, if I give birth, that they'll have to like dart me. Like I'll be running around the hospital screaming and somebody would have to dart me in order to like get me to calm down. But like, you know, again, it's a joke, but it's not. And I think part of it is sort of that, you know, again, shifting the dynamic around it, viewing it as spiritual. I mean, at least for me, it makes it, oh, I can do spiritual things. Like I can do mindful things. I can sit and breathe and go inward. But the thought of like all the other pieces of like the moving elements and stitching and things like that, I'm like, oh God, I don't know if I can do that. So I think that I really, really appreciate this sort of reframing of what this is, because that's really what we're trying to do. I don't even want to say destroy, because I think that there, and again, this is my opinion, alert, an opinion. I think there's almost too much destruction in happening, too much anger. And I don't mean anger like in a bad way. I mean, to reframe something doesn't just take anger. To reframe something takes observation. And I think you need both things. Sometimes you need anger to break through, like the energy to draw up and change. And then you also need the observation and the reflection and the good intention to reorganize in a meaningful way. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I agree.
I feel like you're definitely in that. Can we, I really want to get to some practical, application or advice, I guess, maybe that's a better word, practical advice, preconception during, prenatal while you have a baby inside of you and postnatal. Do you have any rituals that you would recommend, maybe two or three for each stage, that aren't, you know, again, I told this story and I don't think we've released this podcast with Dr. Marin. And I was telling a personal story, you know, of like, when you go into like the doctor's office, they're like, all right, now go try. It's like, thanks. That's helpful. You know, like where's the direction? Like, where's the conversation? Where's the advice? Like there's no bridge until there's a problem. Yeah. And I think that that's part of where I think you guys could do such a beautiful job. So any, advice that you have for people listening?
Yeah, I think there's really three sort of main ones that I kind of want to go over. And the first one, and you know, this one probably seems pretty obvious to people, but it's your food, it's your diet, it's what your body's made of. And if you're approaching a preconception period where you know that soon you want to start trying to get pregnant, it takes your body about 3 months to, you know, extract the egg from the ovary and develop it into a little pod. And then that would deciding which one gets chosen and then it gets released, right? So that process takes about 3 months. The same thing can be said about the sperm. So I think that timeline is really important to put into perspective. If you want to have a conscious conception and you're making the decision to prepare your body for pregnancy, it's very important as the gestating parent that you do, you know, you take the time to plan your diet, to eat healthy, to make sure you have the, you know, nutrients and minerals in your body to optimize the development of that egg. And that takes 3 months. And like I said, same thing with sperms. Now, if you're in a, you know, same-sex partnership, you don't have control necessarily over both of those things, but the gestating parent will have control over that. So that's something to keep in mind. You know, it takes 3 months for that egg or for that sperm to be ready to be implanted. And so you should consider, like, if you're going to do a preconception diet, do it for 3 months minimum. The next thing that I would say is be really careful around stress. I mean, we've been talking about this everywhere, but stress so significantly affects your reproductive hormones. It is huge. So if you're planning to start trying to get pregnant, you need to take actionable steps to reduce lifestyle stress and to find a couple of self-care practices that, you know, are going to downregulate your system and take you out of a stress response. You can't always control necessarily the lifestyle stressors, but you can at the very least find practices that are good for your body, you know, that can reduce stress. So that aspect is really important. The last one I would say, it's not really a tip, but it's just really like a mind frame thing, is manage your expectations. Align your expectations with reality so that you don't set yourself up to have a cascade of unnecessary interventions with getting pregnant. So like most women have no idea, like actually how long it might take to conceive. There's this societal idea or expectation because of how we're taught or not taught sex education. And, you know, a lot of people go through abstinence only, like depending on your upbringing, there's an intense fear of getting pregnant. And there's this common, you know, the common idea is that you could get pregnant at literally any time. And, you know, it's just not so accurate. True. It's just not true about the female body. And, you know, and to go further on that, this is something that I talk about at length in my learning modules and with individual clients, because a lot of people come to me wanting to come off of hormonal birth control. And that's a huge factor for our generation of women who kind of grew up thinking the pill was fine. And then they would go off of it and then they would immediately get pregnant. Well, it takes an average of 8 cycles to have a healthy, robust menstruation cycle before your body is really able to conceive a healthy pregnancy. And people who don't know that are going to start to panic after 2 or 3 months of not getting pregnant because they don't know that information. Their doctor doesn't tell them that. They think that as soon as they go off the pill, they're going to immediately get pregnant. And that's just not true. It doesn't mean something's wrong, that you can't get pregnant. But going into the panic mode and the stress mode of being like, something's wrong with me, could be enough to then further prevent you and your body from being in a state of, you know, maintaining a healthy pregnancy. And so if you're someone who has a history of, you know, being on any type of hormonal birth control, then you need to manage your expectations. And, you know, if you've been using non-hormonal methods for, you know, 10 years, then, and there's an average of 3 to 4 months of before conception. So you expect to try around 4 months before getting pregnant. If you've been on the oral pill, then 7 to 8 months. So that's twice as long as if you weren't. If you had an implant, 11 to 12 months is the average. If you had Depo or any other kind of injection, that's 13 to 15 months. That's 4 times as long as your average person who was using non-hormonal methods of birth control. So that's a huge number of women in this country who, you know, are using hormonal contraceptive and come off of it and have an expectation that they'll get pregnant immediately. And the normal range could be anywhere from twice as long to 4 times as long for your body to be in a place where it's ready. So I mention that only because you need to manage your expectations when you're sort of entering the preconception time.
I think that's so helpful. I really do. I think I don't know if that's really taught to people. And I think that just hearing that is more relaxing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, okay. Thanks for information. You know how relaxing it can feel for information, or now it's a little scary for somebody who maybe has an expectation around it and didn't realize.
I've met so many people who have that and they're mad because their doctor was like, you know, when they, you know, maybe when they got the injection, they thought it was going to be 6 months and then they would be able to get pregnant after right. going off the injection. Well, maybe for like a certain small percentage mm-hmm. of people, but if you're planning your, you know, if you're doing family planning and financial budgeting and organizing your life around this plan, and you think that you can achieve it in 6 months, but it actually takes more like a year and a half, that's a huge problem mm-hmm. and extremely stressful. Yeah. So that's a big mm-hmm. part of it. And unfortunately, most of the time, doctors are not talking about this aspect of hormonal birth control and of achieving pregnancy afterwards.
Yeah. And we do have some resources. I know Dr. Marin, she can treat people out of Colorado and Michigan, who really honors a more holistic approach. She's very knowledgeable. Rachel can help guide and talk to you. And there are a few other people in our community. So definitely reach out to Rachel. I don't want to like put other care providers on the spot, but I know Dr. Marin obviously would be really open. She's so incredible. And Rachel, I feel you can, I think in just in your voice and your approach, when you talk about patience and bearing witness and really truly acknowledging there's so few things we have control over. We have control over our perspective. Well, there's a lot that we have control over, but we have control over our perspective, but there are a few things is what I meant to say. There are a few things that we don't have control over. So for us control fanatics, this journey could be very overwhelming. And so I think, you know, again, ode to our dear friend, Dale, her and I've had some really beautiful conversations about her process and what she did. And, I think that finding somebody that you know has similar values, has done it in a similar way, and talk to them, reach out to them, even if they're not as close to you. This is just more advice. I think that that's something that people don't do as much, and they hold their own emotional experience inside, whether that be about getting pregnant, whether that be about their own depression, whether that be about your anxiety. So just remember that there are so many people, Rachel being one of them, that can bear witness to the inevitabilities that life brings us, the changing, the shifting, the need for transformation.
Mm. Yes, I totally agree. And I'll also say, like, it's helpful for you to talk with people, but it's also incredibly healing for others to share their birth stories. Mm. It's a way for them to... Mm-hmm. you know, narrate and validate the transformation that they went through. So it's really healing and beautiful for both sides.
This is really funny, but birth stories are like one of my favorite things to listen to. I don't know what it is, but I get like, so like when people have babies, they're like, look at my baby. I'm like, tell me about your labor. Like, let me hear about your transformation. Like, they're like, look at my baby. I'm like, tell me about you.
Sounds and to me like you're a doula. I think that there's something, you know, in training.
Let's add it to the list, Rach. Yeah. You know, I think that there is some, that's a really good point to like, to listen to the person and the other parent mm-hmm. too, the dad, you know, watching or other mother or other father, you know, like listening and to what that's like. And I think that there's so much there. So, I'll end us with, just a few last questions, just more about yoga and from a prenatal yoga perspective, what are some modifications that you feel are very important, maybe two or three that are very, very important, or exercises that you think are very like top of your list for preparation?
Well, I think there's this sort of idea that prenatal yoga has to be more gentle or there's less intensity, that you're just going to be stretching because it's not quite safe to do other things. And that's just not true. One of the best things that you can do for your body when you're pregnant, you know, and for most people, this is going to be second trimester and third trimester, because first trimester is like you're exhausted and you're puking and doing exercise sounds terrible. But when you're out of that phase, then coming back to strength training and doing types of yoga that are still very stabilizing for, especially for the pelvic bowl and the core, because mm-hmm. what's happening in pregnancy is your body's preparing to open in every way. And mm-hmm. a lot of the aches and pains of pregnancy have to do with this process of ligaments and joints loosening in order to make space for the baby to come through. And really the only, mm-hmm. you know, thing that you can do to exert control over that, right, coming back to the control thing, is to continue strengthening your muscles, because your muscles will create a boundary and containership for those bones that want to move away from each other, that cause all the aches and pains. And so, you know, if you've taken my prenatal, shout out to all my students, you know that, you know, a lot of the time I am doing strong and intense strengthening. It's not a gentle style that I do. And that's because my teachers and mentors and my learning has shown me that the thing that brings a lot of relief, is to strengthen those muscles to create boundaries and containership for your body. That's really just hormonally speaking, trying to sort of open and come away from other parts, right? So
I think, and one of the things you've mentioned to me in the past is how important it is for just a community. And for those, I do want to honor, I'm going to talk about something that I don't remember the name of, so I apologize to what I'm about to say, and I should probably look it up before I speak. But you'll know, I think Rach is, there is a pregnancy infant loss, and grieving group that Citizen hosts when we are open. We lend our space to them, run by a few women. So if you are interested and you need, support through your own grief, we have those resources as well, and you can reach out to us directly and we can redirect you to the right people. Because I think that's also something to just add on at the end, before we sort of assume that everybody is having a baby and it's easy and it happens. Yes. So I just think that's important to acknowledge.
Because, you know, as we mentioned before in our discussion in multiple places, like, you can't approach the cycles of life and transformation without acknowledging that death is ever present. And if there's one thing that teaches us that, it's observing birth and observing the process of pregnancy. And we can't ignore that. And it's so important to have support and community to share those stories and to be validated in those experiences. So I completely second that. And, you know, if anyone out there is listening, please reach out. And, you know, there are people there who will hold your hand.
Mm-hmm. So, and the last piece was that in prenatal class, you get to meet other people who are going through the same thing. And I think that aside from yoga, you know, we have a prenatal class, not because you have to do so many different things, even though there are some different things, but also for the community of it. Which again is part of what we're addressing, is that our culture has sort of separated us and segregated us from each other. And really the importance is to bring people back
exactly.
together.
Exactly. And I love, you know, even if, you know, to me, it's like, I hear the same sort of like five or six complaints, you know, I know them all, I could list them all, you know, but being able to look at other people and commiserate and be like, oh my God, my tailbone today, or like, what's up with the blah, 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 you know, and just seeing other people who are going through it at the same time and being able to talk and vent and know that someone is experiencing that with you, it makes it feel a lot less lonely. And it's such an important part of our prenatal classes. Mm-hmm. It's harder on Zoom because people are a little more shy about talking, I think. but I really try to leave a lot mm-hmm. of space to encourage people to like ask questions or share or make requests and reach out to me outside of class and just, you know, to validate, like, yeah, it doesn't seem like it should be normal, but there's a lot of weird normal things in pregnancy and, you know, everyone's going through it with you.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Rach. I really appreciate it so much. And your perspective is so helpful. Do you have one last sort of reflection on how you've grown? This is like a big question, but maybe there's just a sentence or two. What has changed or grown for you since starting to teach with Citizen?
Yeah, I think that it's given me an opportunity to be, you know, have an opportunity to have visibility in my authentic self, because, you know, you might have all the convictions in the world and you might have your identity all figured out, which I didn't, you know, until recently, but it's given me an incredible opportunity to choose visibility. And even just in this conversation, to decide to say, yeah, this is who I am. And, you know, not everyone's going to resonate and not everyone's going to agree, and that's okay. But making the choice to say, like, this is spiritual for me, or this is political for me, or I identify as someone who's radical, and going out there and being able to join your community and stand tall in that identity has been huge for me and for my personal growth to be, you know, coming back to the being seen thing. You know, that to me has been, especially this year in particular, to sort of have language around saying, like, yeah, I'm a spiritual doula. Like, yeah, I, you know, being able to say that, it used to be really hard. Even just acknowledging it took me a long time to realize that that's what I was trying to say. So anyway, I think that in being part of Citizen and in my own journey, that one of the most important things that's really been resonating for me is, you know, a lot of ideas and themes around visibility and authenticity.
Awesome. Well, thank you. I appreciate that you're a part of our community. I appreciate your reflections and your knowledge. And if people want to get in touch with you, Rach,
They can come and find me on social media. I'm at @_Rach_S. And then from there, you can find links to my website. My business name is Revenir Services. So it's R-E-V-E-N-I-R services.com. And there's a contact page there. You can find me in social. You can find me on the Citizen site. You can come to my class, different ways. But I'm usually pretty responsive on Instagram and Facebook. So any of those ways are fine.
Well, thank you for taking your time with us today. And I hope this was helpful for listeners. And again, part of this podcast is about just offering resources, not just, you know, introducing new perspectives. So hopefully people also discover new ways of approaching regular things that they are preparing to do, like maybe have a child, maybe.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the opportunity. And maybe I love having these kinds of conversations. It really is so enriching, and I love it. So thank you so much for hosting me.